I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Call him the tourist in chief. While President Obama is in the Gulf today to survey damage, governors and businesses are eager to also illustrate that many beaches are still oil-free and open for business. President Obama is visiting Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida, staying over into tomorrow. His last three visits to the Gulf have been to Louisiana, which has suffered the most damage so far. But then the president returns to Washington to deliver his first Oval Office speech to the nation on the catastrophe, announcing a new multi-billion-dollar victims compensation fund, which he says he is ordering BP to set up. Joel Achenbach is covering the story for The Washington Post. And Joel, first of all, the president has been criticized for not having a face-to-face meeting with BP's chief executive, Tony Hayward. Now, Hayward, will be testifying before Congress tomorrow. Obama will meet with him on Wednesday after this speech. What's the thinking from the White House?
This situation is between the federal government, Robin, and BP has been an unhappy marriage, but they've not yet called in the lawyers. You know, no one has said, see you in court. What they're trying to do is, you know, keep some kind of working, you know, relationship going where the Obama administration, first of all, can get some political points for saying, look, we made BP do this. BP will probably let the administration win a few of these rounds, for example, with the administration demanding that there be this escrow account created to help adjudicate all the claims from people who have been hurt by the spill. But what BP is most worried about is they want to make sure they aren't liable for all the economic damage that would include damage from the drilling moratorium that the Obama administration has put forward. Anyway, about Wednesday's meeting, so it's Obama will meet Hayward face-to-face for the first time. They've never even spoken. And Obama will also meet the chairman of the board.
Well, some are saying, this criticism that they haven't spoken in over 50 days has become the rallying cry for Republicans on talk shows and for, you know, people picking it up who live in the Gulf. Why hasn't he met with the BP CEO? But others are saying that this gives the appearance that the president does not step down to confer with a buddy in the oil industry. In fact, he's going to, on national television, order him to do something. So it doesn't appear that it's been sort of negotiated.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the White House is usually pretty savvy about how they want to position the president, and I think they probably didn't want the president, you know, shaking hands with Tony Hayward, as they recognized that Hayward was the officially anointed bad guy in all this. I mean, Hayward he's gaffe prone. You know, he said this thing about, I want my life back. Mm. So he's not politically very savvy sometimes, and I don't think they really wanted Obama and Hayward in the same frame for a while there.
Well, and Hayward, I just want to ask you, sorry to interrupt, Joel, but Hayward is going to be testifying before Congress along with the other big five oil companies. They've all been called in. What's expected to happen there? They certainly would want to distance themselves from this spill.
Yeah, the other four oil companies will say that BP was reckless, and that their practices didn't represent the industry norms, and that they will, it's really in their interest to try to isolate this situation and say, you know, this is an anomaly. The rest of us are very safe in what we do. We have lots of redundancies, and if we ever had a blowout, our blowout preventer would work, and so on.
Well, as far as the compensation, though, we've got about a minute. This new compensation fund that the president is ordering, do we know how that's going to work? Do we know who's going to administer that?
That's a key question, Robin, which is it going to be someone that BP will be comfortable with? Because BP doesn't have to do this unless, I mean, they have to agree to it. And they're only going to agree to it if they feel that it's someone who's apolitical, who's not there to win political points for Obama or for the Democrats, but someone who will, you know, be a fair arbiter, you know, someone like, you know, a Colin Powell type figure who the company would recognize as being fair. And also, most of all, they want to make sure that there's some parameter on what their liability is. They don't want to be responsible for the economic damage from the drilling moratorium.
Well, and I'm sure governors want them to be. That's Joel Achenbach of the Washington Post with the latest on the president's week ahead in the oil crisis. Joel, thanks as always.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Let's turn now to Afghanistan, where June has been an especially deadly month. Of the 40 international troops killed, 27 were Americans. This carnage is familiar to the men who served in 2nd Platoon Battle Company of the 173rd Airborne Brigade in 2008 and 2007. They were the focus of frequent Taliban attacks in the Korangal Valley. Nearly 50 men died trying to hold that valley, and then the U.S. military abandoned it in April. Now, we heard Defense Secretary Robert Gates recently say that public support for this war will decline without progress, and we know there have been only limited gains from the last offensive in Marja earlier this year, and the U.S. military is also looking at the Kandahar offensive, which is supposed to take place this summer, and questioning whether that should be slowed down. Journalist Sebastian Younger joins us now. We want to talk to him about all of this. He was embedded with 2nd Platoon. He chronicles the time there, many of the deaths they suffered in his new book, which is simply titled War. So, Sebastian, right now we're seeing suicide attacks and car bombs in Afghanistan. But the soldiers you were with, they were often face-to-face with the Taliban.
Yeah, it was old-fashioned warfare. It was on foot. They had shovels and picks to dig defensive positions and, patrols that would go down valley during the day or during the night and get ambushed. And, it was something that you easily could have seen in Vietnam or World War II.
Yeah, and it was to keep Taliban from moving through this pass from Pakistan into Afghanistan and bringing extra forces in. It seemed like a good old-fashioned military endeavor. It was also part of what, the military told us was taking the fight to the enemy. And you write in the book that's what they said was the reason for an uptick in deaths, and we've seen this in the last few years. But you write it lacked any acknowledgement that the enemy was definitely getting their act, for lack of a better word, together. So again, as you see these deaths, is that what you see, Taliban getting their act together?
2007 was when the Taliban, as a military force, really sort of came together and began to work really effectively. It is true that when the U.S. military, any military, mounts offensive operations, helicopters crash, Jeeps collide and men get killed in combat. It's part of what war is. But the Taliban, I think as a result of our real lack of commitment in 2001-02, when we had the enormous goodwill of the Afghan people for having destroyed the Taliban, our lack of commitment in those early years really made the Afghan people sort of scratch their heads like, is the United States serious here or not? Because 15,000 troops, which is what we left there, are not going to do the job. Now here we are 8-9 years later, and we're fighting a real war now. It was not a real war in 2002-03, and it's really too bad we didn't capitalize on it then.
We have 30,000 more troops, a total of 90,000 in Afghanistan. But as you write, the troops that you were with who were in combat, they don't think about that. They weren't thinking about what was going on in the rest of the country. They weren't even thinking really about, the overall mission in Afghanistan.
Yeah, I'm always surprised when civilians are surprised by that. I mean, they're a lot like the police or the fire department. I mean, the police in Dorchester aren't thinking that much about Arlington. They're fighting
here in Boston, yeah.
Yeah, they're fighting crime in their town and trying to survive it. So the soldiers are very much like that. They have a tour of duty, 15 months. They come back, they have a year, and then they head back over again. And the war could be going great everywhere else, but if it's going bad where they are, they're going to get killed, and that's the focus of their concern.
Well, there's about to be a major offensive against the Taliban in Kandahar. So given that, what's coming up, let's look back at what took place in this Korangal Valley. How does Korangal fit into the war? Tell us more.
Well, the Korangal was a very small, intense valley. I mean, by that, I mean the locals were very kind of hardcore, very independent. They'd rebuffed the Russians. They rebuffed the Taliban. The American forces probably got as far into that valley as anyone has and probably had better relations with the locals than anyone really has. But that that doesn't mean it was particularly good in there. There was a lot of fighting. The guys I was with were in almost 500 firefights during their deployment. A fifth of all the combat in all of Afghanistan was happening within those 6 miles. Almost 50 Americans were killed, and hundreds of Taliban were killed. And actually, before the American pullout, the Taliban themselves had decreased operations in that valley because I think it was just too costly for them.
Well, the American pullout, even when you say that, after having read the book, all the blood and sweat and tears shed on this ground, and then there was a pullout. Have you talked since to the troops about what does that mean to them?
I have talked with them. I'm in very close touch with the guys I was with over there. On an emotional level, it's very painful. You know, they lost their best friends out there. They were all almost killed out there. I mean, literally every single guy in that platoon was almost killed many times. So it's a painful thing for them, but they also understand this is what war is. I mean, what's Gettysburg right now? It's a farm. You know, it's not important in any grand sense. It's where the two armies happen to meet. Every war has its Hamburger Hill, its Coringall Valley, its Dunkirk, for that matter.
Hamburger Hill in Vietnam.
Yeah. That's the irony and the tragedy of war is that men lose their lives for pieces of terrain that have no other significance except that the men are there fighting.
Well, let's listen to what they thought they were doing there. You made a documentary film as well as writing the book. Photojournalist Tim Hetherington was with you when you both went into combat with these troops. Here are some of the troops from 2nd Platoon talking about why the Coringall, where they were stationed, was important strategically.
When the boys built that base, Taliban or the AAF forces in the valley, they were completely in shock. It was like a middle finger sticking out. And they realized once they could not knock off OP Restrepo, we had the upper hand. They started becoming afraid.
Get some, Taliban! Woo!
Hey, hit the bottom right. Hit the bottom right of the village.
Get this!
Explain what we were just hearing. That I know you laugh, but you really are very straightforward. You've been complimented on sort of an unadorned look at what happens during war. You say one of the things you say is war is a lot of things, and it's useless to pretend exciting isn't one of them. It's insanely exciting. It's life multiplied by some number no one's ever heard of. Don't underestimate the things young men will wager in order to play this game one more time. Now, that can sound so chilling, given the death toll. So what are you saying there?
These guys were very good at fighting, and it was the only thing up there for them. They had nothing on that hilltop. There was no television. There was no women. There was no alcohol. There was no internet. There was no phone. There was no cooked food. There wasn't even running water.
No reading, no games, no
nothing.
Nothing.
There were sandbags and boxes of ammo. And all they had to do was talk with each other, which I think was a great source of comfort for them, and fight. And fighting, whatever the political ramifications are in their grave, and they, you know, need to be discussed back here in society, but for the guys who are doing the fighting, it is about the most intense thing they will ever do. So if too many days went by without a firefight, they would get itchy.
They would punch each other.
Well, you know, they're young men. They're pretty rough with each other. They called each other brother. There was a form of love up there. Love in the sense that, as one guy said, there are guys who hate each other, but we'd all die for each other.
That's Sebastian Younger. He gets to the heart of that brotherhood in Afghanistan in a scene in his new book, War. A new officer arrives to command the platoon, and the troops jump him and beat him up. They call it Blood In. That's a way to initiate someone. They got it from a movie. But when we come back, will that brotherhood be the thing that holds the military together if the war in Afghanistan is extended? By the way, an excerpt of Sebastian's book at our website, hereandnow.org. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Sebastian Younger. His new book, War, focuses on a group of soldiers in Afghanistan's Coringall Valley in 2007 and 8. The documentary that Sebastian directed of that time is called Restrepo. It's named after the medic who was killed there. And Sebastian, a military correspondent Tom Rick says he fears that the all-volunteer military will fall apart if military spouses aren't attended to. He says they're the ones who keep the troops going back time after time. But in reading your book, I was thinking that it seems like there's something else getting these soldiers to go back. What is that?
The guys I was with, they were at a 15-man outpost isolated on a hilltop, 500 firefights for a year. And they came back to Italy where they're based. And they sort of boozed it up for a few weeks and saw their girlfriends or whatever. And after a few weeks, they wanted to go back. Everyone ascribes that to, oh, now they're adrenaline junkies. They're addicted to combat. And that's really a very shallow interpretation of what's going on. I think the real drug that they're addicted to is they were part of a brotherhood up there. And every single guy was completely necessary to everyone else. Everyone knew what was expected of them. and what others would do for them. And that, for a 19-year-old who otherwise back home would be completely adrift in this society, just another guy looking for a job, for a guy like that, the intensity and the clarity of combat is a huge relief. So the guys come home to society and they don't have much of a role for themselves, and they really, as bad as it was out there, they actually miss it.
And what does the military learn from that? Again, you know, we're looking at going into Kandahar. This is not, President Obama is talking about a drawdown of troops, but doesn't seem imminent. It sounds as if the rallying cry isn't, you know, get the Taliban or Osama bin Laden. It sounds like, I mean, they rarely talk that way. It was more about supporting each other.
Well, they're 30 men, and they're not supposed to see the big picture. Kandahar was the heart of the Taliban insurgency. I mean, of course, the Taliban were created in Pakistan. The Afghans really saw them as a foreign occupation. They're willing to trade that indignity for the stability that the Taliban brought in the early 90s. But that wore thin, and they were really, really, the Afghans were really grateful to see the Taliban go. They were very grateful to us. I was there in 01. It was pretty extraordinary feeling. I would get hugged by Afghans on the street because I was American. But the Taliban are rooted in Kandahar, and without bringing stability to Kandahar, Afghanistan will never be stable.
Back to the troops that you spend so much time with, they sort of devolve. You even, I think you used the phrase Lord of the Flies at one point when some animal gets stuck in the barbed wire and gets eaten. But, you know, you use that phrase and you paint images of troops down to their boxer shorts and unlaced boots with cigarettes hanging out of their mouths, you know, firing off weaponry. And you've had some critics because of that. David Langness writes in Paste that you're glorifying camaraderie, glorifying the survival instinct, maybe even, you know, getting a taste of it yourself. And you talk about that, you know, how you're sort of pulled in. I'm a journalist. I'd never carry a gun. Maybe I'd help them carry some ammunition if I'm needed, you know. So do you feel you do that, romanticize it?
I think romanticize is a pretty loaded word. I mean, the men themselves were drawn to what they were doing. And I was trying to understand the appeal for them. I don't think they were romanticizing it. I think they were drawn to something very real, and they were willing to risk their lives to get it. I think my book did a good job at unpacking that and explaining something very contradictory, which is war is a terrible thing. You see your best friends get killed. You know, men in combat get PTSD. It's an awful experience. So why do they miss it? I don't think explaining that really is a romanticizing of the topic.
Where are these guys now, the guys who saw this terrible, I mean, terrible, terrible death around them?
Some are in Kunar province fighting. They returned in December 09, very close to the Korangal, and resumed their duties. The rest are at various military bases around the country, except for one who got out of the army, Brendan O'Byrne.
What's he doing? Because he sort of became the face, he's the cover of your book, but he became the face, the spokesperson even for some of these troops. He could say what they couldn't sometimes.
Yeah, he was very articulate about the emotional and moral complexity of what they were doing. And I think, I wondered at one point, is his sensitivity to all this, is that going to be the thing that sort of saves him, allows him to process all this successfully, or is it going to be the thing that destroys him? Because he really was so sort of vulnerable to doubt. And I think he got back to the U.S. and he just crashed. I mean, he was a train wreck. And he got married, he put himself back together. He's no longer a danger to himself. I think he was in more danger in the year afterward than he was when he was out in the Korangal. And he's doing very well right now. He's working and waiting for his wife to come home from Africa. She's deployed with the Marines in Djibouti.
Here's a little bit more from your documentary about the toll that this experience takes on some of the troops. Let's listen.
I can't even sleep, honestly. I've been on about 4 or 5 different types of sleeping pills and none of them help. That's how bad the nightmares are. I prefer not to sleep, not dream about it, than sleep and just see the picture in my head. Is pretty bad.
So again, Sebastian Younger, square that with, you know, the thing that you explained was a game that people want to keep going back to.
Yeah. I mean, that's what's confusing to them. It's so traumatizing. And yet when they get home, life doesn't feel meaningful and they want to go back. And I mean, it's like missing a really bad marriage after the divorce. Like, wait, what is it I'm missing again? Because that was hell. That's what's so confusing to these guys. This particular guy was named Cortez. He ran up a hill to try to save his friends who were being overrun by a Taliban attack, and he got there too late, and his best friend, Larry Rugel, was lying dead with a bullet in his forehead. And the dream that he had every night afterward was that he was back on that hillside trying to run fast enough to save his friend. I hope he's free of those dreams, but it's traumatic, and human body processes trauma very slowly. For most of those guys, I think successfully, but it does take a while.
Sebastian Younger, his new book is War. It's the time he spent with 2nd Platoon in Afghanistan as they tried to hold on to a pass that's now been given up by the U.S. military. Sebastian, thanks so much for coming in to talk to us about it.
My pleasure.
FIFA is defending the Vuvuzela today. If that makes no sense to you, then you haven't been following World Cup soccer. The Vuvuzela is that plastic horn being blown nonstop during the games. Spanish striker David Villa says you can't communicate anything to a teammate who's more than 10 meters away. The horns were introduced last year at soccer matches in South Africa. FIFA, the ruling organization, says they're related to horns that South Africans used to use to call meetings, and guests should embrace the culture, even if in this form it sounds like a swarm of bees. By the way, Germany and Ghana are looking impressive in the cup. The U.S. upset England and many of the English by tying. Well, there was also a buzz at Boston's TD Garden last night. The Celtics beating the Lakers to take a 3-2 lead in the NBA Finals. The Celtics now one game away from their 18th title, but the Lakers will be on home turf for Game 6 tomorrow night. Let's touch down quickly with Jeff Zilgit, NBA sports reporter for USA Today. Jeff, Kobe Bryant hot last night. He's going to be in front of the hometown crowd tomorrow. Do you think that's going to be the determining factor?
I'm not sure if Kobe himself will be the determining factor. I think the Lakers need help from some of his teammates if they want to force a Game 7.
Well, the Boston Herald's Steve Bulpit quotes the English poet John Donne saying that no man is an island except maybe Kobe Bryant. But then he goes on to say the Celtics, in that case, are an archipelago. They have a chain of islands.
It's a great analogy by Steve in that the Celtics don't rely on one guy every night. Right now and throughout the playoffs, the Celtics have been a true team from, you know, the starting five, the big three plus Rondo or the big four, even to the bench, which was very instrumental in the Celtics winning Game 4.
Let's talk just a little bit about the Celtics bench. You've got Big Baby, Glenn Davis, and little Nate Robinson. I mean, if you haven't seen the games, an extreme in size. In fact, Nate is referring to them as Shrek and the Donkey. They're not first string. They come off the bench to really fire up the Celts.
Absolutely. Doc refers them as the emotional bunch of the team, and that's saying something when you have such an emotional guy as Kevin Garnett as the starter. But on any team, and this is what the Los Angeles is really missing among some help from their starters, is that they don't have those bench players, those role players who know how to come in, not only fire up the team, but they fire up the crowd. And when they go to Los Angeles, it will be firing up the team and putting the crowd back in their seats.
Jeff Zilgit, NBA sports reporter for USA Today. Game 6, Lakers-Celtics tomorrow. Jeff, thanks so much.
Hey, thank you, Robin.
And finally, another sports note that just happens to come from Boston but has inspired ballplayers everywhere. On Saturday, 27-year-old Daniel Nava stepped to the plate, his first game with the Red Sox, his first game in the major leagues, to receive his first pitch.
Base is loaded, nobody out, and there's a drive hit deep to right field, way back, and it is gone into the Red Sox bullpen.
And with that, Danny Nava became only the second player in Major League history to hit a grand slam on his first pitch.
As I was rounding the bases, I think that's when I kind of said, no way, I just hit a grand slam. And so that's probably why I was sprinting the whole time, because I was just so obviously pumped for that moment, that opportunity.
Now, Nava's parents were at the game. They'd rushed to Boston when they heard their son was being pulled up from the minor league Pawtucket Red Sox to play for the Big Sox. Dad Don Nava said he cried so hard when his son hit that grand slam that he needed Band-Aids for his eyes. And the story gets even better. Danny Nava's mom, Becky, remembered that when Danny was cut from his college team at the University of Santa Clara, he became the equipment manager just to stay in the game, often doing the team's laundry at 3 in the morning.
He would call from the laundromat and say, I'm here for 3 hours, got my quarters. Mom, I know how to get spots out now.
So Danny Nava, an added bonus, he hits grand slams and gives laundry tips. By the way, thanks to Johnny Miller of WBZ Radio for that sound. Danny becomes the second Red Sox player to hit a grand slam in his first at-bat with the Sox, the second player in Major League Baseball history to hit a grand slam on his first pitch. So who was the first? I'll give you 5 seconds. It was Kevin Kuzmanoff of the Cleveland Indians in 2006. Kudos to all. Back in 30 seconds, here and now. So where are we on campaign finance reform? The landscape of money in politics changed dramatically last January when the Supreme Court ruled in that Citizens United case that corporations and advocacy organizations such as labor groups can spend unlimited corporate cash on campaigns because, like individuals, they have freedom of speech. So they can support, say, the pro-business U.S. Chamber of Commerce and, in turn, whatever candidates they support. The justices did leave the door open for Congress to write rules requiring disclosure, you know, who's behind donations. But the Supreme Court ruling sent states scrambling to rewrite their campaign finance laws. And then the court also upended one state's law that was already in place. Last week, on Primary Tuesday, the Supreme Court issued a temporary ban of Arizona's public financing system, blocking matching grants to candidates who agreed to forego big money donations. Money also played a big role in California and in Blanche Lincoln's reelection bid in Arkansas. So let's take a look with Carol Lennig. She covers elections and campaign finance for The Washington Post. So, Carol, there are a lot of misunderstandings about this ruling. First of all, what does it allow? Because can Citizens United or unions donate directly to individual politicians like, say, Blanche Lincoln?
They can, but they have to give it through their PACs and individuals, and there are limits on how they do that. Corporate executives can give money through their political action committees. There is a way corporate money makes its way into a candidate's coffers. But this ruling does not say that a company, a large Forbes 500, Forbes 1000, can write corporate checks to a candidate. The ruling said that corporations are entitled to have an individual's free speech rights, and they can advocate and get engaged in campaigns by running essentially campaign ads and financing them with unlimited corporate money. If they choose, they can flood the zone in a campaign by, as a union did in the Blanche Lincoln race, run millions of dollars worth of ads advocating for a position.
For instance, in that campaign, the issue was union check cards, the way someone can join a union by checking off a card at their place of work. That was the issue that they could pour a lot of money into.
Yes, unions were very, very peeved, to put it mildly, with Blanche Lincoln. Many people viewed that race as one in which unions were trying to tell moderate Democrats, you can be moderate, just don't fight union members and don't fight unionization efforts.
Well, and that brings us to the door that the Supreme Court left open for Congress to draft some sort of rules of disclosure. Democrats in the White House support a bill called the Disclose Act. It would force corporations and unions, labor groups, to disclose how much they're donating, for what cause, and who they are. So tell us a little bit more about what the act would call for.
The act is pretty broad and detailed. It would require CEOs who fund an ad to do stand-by-your-ad appearances on the television or the radio. In cases where it's a trade association or an alliance or a coalition of groups, it would require disclosure of the top five corporate entities that have donated to fund this ad. It would require that federal contractors be barred from donating to groups or coalitions that fund campaign ads. Many issues of this proposal are contentious, and some would probably trigger constitutional challenges. The federal contractors would argue, why are we denied free speech?
Well, but they're being allowed the free speech. They're just being told you have to claim it. It can't be anonymous.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, there is a huge fight brewing over this central point. For many years, Republicans have said, don't limit the donations. Just have corporations disclose. Democrats have said, no, you need limits, you need controls, you can't have unlimited corporate funding, it would be dangerous to campaigns. Well, now here comes Citizens United, and Republicans are now saying that they actually think disclosure will squelch corporate speech, and that they think corporations are essentially the new whipping boy of modern times.
Well, we're also hearing that this Disclose Act has created strange bedfellows, groups that have memberships, the National Rifle Association, for instance, and the AFL-CIO, completely different groups, but they both have memberships. They're making the claim that since they're not a corporation, they represent these members, they have the responsibility to remain anonymous to protect membership, that it'll chill the smaller donors who might be a part of their membership.
It's hard to imagine how that could be a legitimate concern, because the Disclose Act has such high limits for who would be identified. However, there are concerns by trade associations and others that they'd have to provide membership lists. That's a whole separate legal battle going on at the moment right now. But really, a lot of the Disclose Act provisions have to do with the largest dollar donors.
Right. Well, and how are states reacting to all of this?
A lot of states, half the states have spending limits for corporations, and those limits are now vulnerable and challenged or under challenge because of Citizens United. And some states haven't had corporate limits on spending in elections. For example, Florida, Georgia, they say, look at us. You know, we haven't had some widespread corruption going on as a result of corporations being able to fund issue ads. There have been no problems. However, there have been some instances that are pretty interesting. For example, in Florida, an alliance of trial lawyers formed a group which gave a lot of money to a social welfare group which ran attack ads against somebody who was for tort reform. And you did not know, as a reporter or a member of the public, until after the campaign, who financed those ads.
Well, Carol Lenig, one last question. What do you make of the Supreme Court's decision last week to temporarily halt Arizona's public financing system while the court considers whether to take a case challenging it? We remember that under the Arizona law, the state gave money to candidates who rejected big private donations, but then these privately funded candidates objected, saying that the law forced them to limit how much they raised because they didn't want their opponents to get the same amount of money in matching funds. They said that, in effect, the law had a chilling effect on their free speech or their ability to raise money. But the ruling from the court to stop public financing came in the middle of a campaign. Governor Jan Brewer was expecting public money, and hers has been cut in half by this decision. Meanwhile, her opponent raised over $2 million. So what's your thoughts about this ruling?
This is such a fascinating one, Robin, because basically it's not partisan. Both parties are going to be harmed by this. You mentioned the sitting governor. I think she was supposed to get a check cut for $1.2 million this week, and now she's going to have to run a campaign she didn't really sign up to run. So Republicans and Democrats are going to be hindered by this decision to some extent, and some Republicans and some Democrats are going to be aided by it.
That's Carol Lenig, staff writer for The Washington Post. Carol, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. So how much oil is floating around in the Gulf? Experts have been trying to guess at that for over a month now. Our next guest, Sanjoy Mahajan, teaches guessing at MIT, and he's taught science at Cambridge University in England. He says guessing is an essential life skill, for instance, to figure out quickly if maybe something you read in the paper or hear on the radio is true. Sanjoy's forthcoming book is Street Fighting Tools for Science and Engineering. His previous book, Street Fighting Mathematics. We want to talk to him about street fighting and guessing and asked him first to explain the street fighting aspect.
In a street fight, nobody cares about the beauty of your form. So just do whatever works. Don't just stand there. Try to get an answer, even if it's a rough approximate answer. It's a rough world out there.
And this brings us to your bumper sticker, because we know you've said over and over, if you try to be too exact, it's paralyzing. Or rigor leads to
rigor mortis.
So we asked Sanjoy to apply his thinking to the oil gusher in the Gulf. Now, we know that scientists now say that well could be spewing out 30, maybe as many as 50,000 barrels every day. But to keep things mathematically simple, we asked Sanjoy to use 10,000 barrels.
Now, that number itself, 10,000 barrels, well, if you convert it to gallons, it's 400,000 gallons a day. But these are all huge numbers. They don't have any actual meaning in terms of human experience. So you can't feel them in your gut. So the first principle is you have to convert all numbers to something you can feel. How many barrels per day do we use, for example, for cars? Well, how many miles per day do we drive per car, let's say? I don't know, 50 miles. And let's say cars get 25 miles per gallon. So that's 2 gallons per day per car. Now, how many cars are there? Well, my cynical view is that there almost everybody in America owns a car, including babies. So let's say there's about 200 or 300 million cars. So now we're talking something like 400 million gallons per day used for cars. Now let's convert that to barrels, 40 gallons per barrel. So the 400 million gallons per day works out to be about 10 million barrels per day. Now we can compare 10,000 barrels per day pouring into the Gulf, 10 million barrels per day used for cars. That's a factor of 1,000. So that one gusher is 1,000th of our car usage, which tells me if we could cut our car consumption down by, say, 10%, we would reduce our gas consumption by 100 of those gushers in the well. So we could close 100 offshore drilling rigs just by doing simple conservation. And that's the kind of number that has a meaning. So I want the students to have a confidence with any number that they see and not throw up their hands and say, oh, well, I never learned that in one of my courses. We didn't take a course on barrels of oil. Yeah, exactly. You'll never take a course on exactly what you need to know. You need to be flexible in your knowledge.
Do you find yourself as you go through the day making these calculations?
Oh, yeah, all the time.
Like how?
For example, when I'm on a plane, I look at the monitor, which tells you how high you're flying and what's the temperature. And I want to see, well, does that make sense that it's minus 55 or 70 degrees Fahrenheit when you're 30,000 feet up? Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Taxiing down the runway, I hold up my keys and see what angle they hold at to figure out the acceleration of the plane, to figure out its takeoff speed. What speed do they have to slow down to land? On a train, I want to figure out the gas mileage of the train. One time I was having dinner with my students. They had some Jell-O, which was basically not edible. So they started experimenting with the Jell-O and trying to figure out how stiff is the Jell-O. They passed the Jell-O around to the other side of the table, and our side of the table did some experiments. How stiff is the Jell-O? Is it as stiff as a weak spring? Is it stiff like balsa wood? Just because it was fun.
Well, you know, speaking of those students at Cambridge University in a physics course there, I had to be very bright students. And yet you felt what about their ability to reason?
I thought it had been chloroformed by the standard methods of teaching, to use actually a phrase that the old superintendent of schools in Manchester, New Hampshire, said about the standard math teaching. Back in the 1930s, he said that. And I think that that's true about most science and mathematics teaching. It's nothing short of a holy miracle if you come out with your curiosity intact.
Because why?
Because it's mostly taught as, here are the formulas to remember, and not as a way of looking at the world.
Well, and you want to look at methods that were taught in math, for instance. Is it Louis Benazet and
yes.
his teaching? Why?
Yeah.
What? Just give us a little bit of what was different.
What he did was he said the standard arithmetic teaching is producing people who just reason by rote. And one of the modern examples of that is when students are asked, there are 26 sheep and 10 goats on a ship. How old is the captain? Hmm. A large fraction, 80%, say 36.
They add the sheep and the goats.
Yeah. And also studies show that the longer you stay in school, the more likely they are to do that kind of operation, because they've learned math doesn't have any meaning. All you have to do is just combine numbers together and you get something.
By the way, how do you answer that question?
You can't. There's no way to answer that question.
Trick.
So Benazet noticed this problem 80 years ago, and he said, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to have a curriculum that emphasizes estimating, reading, writing, and explaining. And we're not going to do the formal arithmetic algorithms until grade 6 and 7. And instead, they just compared things bigger, smaller, 2 times bigger, 3 times bigger. It was much more effective.
Well, leave us with one more example of a guesstimate you can make.
How many? Well, this is maybe more relevant since I just had a baby
yes,
last week.
Yes, congratulations.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
How many dollars per year are spent on diapers? So the first question is, well, how many babies are there? Okay, well, let's say between 0 and 2 is a baby, so 2 years. And there's 300 million people in the U.S., and let's say everybody lives till 75 and then they die. So that's about 4 million people, 300 over 75 per year. So for 2 years, that's 8 million babies. Now, how many diapers do they use? Well, I used to think one per day until I actually had a baby. So, yeah, more like 8 per day, let's say. But it slows down later. So let's say it's something like 5 per day. So about 15 or 1,800 per year. Now, how much does each diaper cost? I don't know, maybe 10 or 20 cents. So it's something like $300 a year times 8 million babies. That's $2 or $3 billion a year. So that's Ta-da. The size of the diaper market. Now, is that correct? I went to look for this online by doing some online searching, and there are various reports you can find about this, but they cost about $1,000 to get hold of. So I didn't know if it was worth it to me to pay for it. But it shows that it's actually a worthwhile skill to be able to make these estimates.
So now we know what new dads do at 3 in the morning when they're changing diapers. Sanjoy Mahajan, Associate Director of the Teaching and Learning Lab at MIT, where he also teaches classes on educated guessing. His forthcoming book is Street Fighting Tools for Science and Engineering. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
The American Theater Wing's Tony goes to...
And this quick note, it was hooray for Hollywood at Broadway's Tony Awards last night. Three Hollywood stars, Denzel Washington, Catherine Zeta-Jones, and Scarlett Johansson, picking up acting trophies. The two-man drama Red, about painter Mark Rothko, was the big winner, picking up 6 awards, including Best Play. And then there was Memphis. The rhythm and blues musical picked up 4 Tonys, including Best Musical. Here's Steal Your Rock and Roll, the most downloaded from the show. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us to see what the week brings, Here and Now. Lisa!